Recently, I watched a new film called War Machine. I wouldn't recommend it. It's not very good. And one of the reasons it's not very good is that the moment something bad happens, all the soldiers can't cope. They break, they fall apart. And it's left to the hero not only to maintain his own composure, but to motivate the others too. And that just doesn't happen in real life. From personal experience, when a soldier finds themselves in a tricky situation, you may have a mild panic, a little bit of a flap, but you soon suppress that as your training and experience takes over and you get on with the task in hand. Lots of films and novels do this. They have professional soldiers fall apart in battle. And it's just not realistic, and I really don't like it. And obviously, the Gospel writer Matthew wasn't aware of my views on that sort of thing. Because verse 4 of the reading we heard, the guards were so afraid of the angel that they shook and became like dead men. In fairness, I doubt that the Roman army had an immediate action drill for the sudden appearance of an angel from heaven. If the guards were seriously expecting any trouble at the tomb, they probably thought it would be a handful of ragamuffin fishermen or a bunch of middle-aged women who they could easily repel with a few jabs of their javelins. All four of the Gospels record slightly different elements of the account of the women arriving at the tomb to discover the stone rolled away, the tomb empty, and Jesus nowhere to be found. Matthew is the only one who tells us how the stone actually was rolled away, and I love the detail that he gives. Traditionally, it's believed that Matthew was one of the 12 disciples of Jesus, also known as Levi, the tax collector. And I've no reason to doubt that, and it makes sense that he actually knew these women disciples of Jesus. Matthew is able to give a detailed and accurate account. At first glance of the text, it can seem quite a casual incident. Yeah, there was an earthquake and, by the way, that happened because an angel came down from heaven. He mooched along to the tomb and he rolled the stone away and he sat on it. Seems quite a laid-back sort of action. And I love the thought of this 8-foot-tall, fearless being gleaming like lightning in the hazy early morning light. Just popping down from heaven, strolling through the garden, nodding to the guards, "Morning, lads," and moving this massive stone that weighed the best part of 2 tons as if it was nothing. And then he plops himself down on the stone as if he wants to just close his eyes, breathe in the peace and calm and tranquility of that morning. Not at all surprising that the guards watching all this shook with fear and froze like dead men. The first task of the angel was to roll the stone away. He didn't himself have a hand in returning Jesus to life, but his job was to provide the evidence to demonstrate that Jesus was in fact risen from the dead. Had it been humans who had rolled the stone away, there could have been accusations that they had knocked out the guards and pinched the body. But with both the women disciples and the Roman guards testifying that it was an angel, this could only have been a supernatural incident. The angel's second task was to encourage the women to give their own testimony of what they had seen. He reminds them that Jesus told them he would rise again. He shows them the empty tomb, and he instructs them to go and tell the rest of the disciples. I hope I'm not stretching things too far to say that that resonates with our own Easter experience. Firstly, we have to see and to understand for ourselves that Jesus is risen from the dead. Last week, when we had the year three children in the garden exploring some Easter themes, we stood by my makeshift tomb and I asked the children what the women found when they got there. And they all knew the answer. They all replied, "The stone was rolled away." And so, my brothers and sisters, this morning, have you seen for yourself that the stone was rolled away? Have you, like Mary and Peter, stuck your head in and seen and understood that Jesus is not there? That he has risen just as he said he would? And secondly, having seen and understood for ourselves, we have to follow the angel's instruction and go and tell others. And it's then, having seen and understood for themselves and been obedient to go and tell the good news, it's then that the women encounter the risen Christ. Seeing and understanding for ourselves, obeying the command to tell the good news, a personal encounter with the risen Lord Jesus. What a fantastic morning that would be. I was trying to come up with some fresh new take on the Easter story, some deep, profound insight that no one else had ever thought of. And then, of course, I realised that's very silly. For the best part of 2,000 years, Christians have believed that Christ died for us and that he rose again, defeating death and defeating sin forever. Sometimes the reason for Jesus' death is caged in legal courtroom language. Our sin, our failure, our disobedience, whatever you want to call it, demanded a punishment. A righteous God, a just God, God the judge, couldn't let our crimes go unpunished. But rather than punish us, he took that punishment upon himself. The crucifixion that we deserve, God took upon himself as Jesus surrendered his life to corrupt humans. Elsewhere, the reason for Jesus' death is articulated in the ancient language of sacrifice and atonement. The Apostle Paul, writing here in Romans 5, talks of God's wrath, his anger at humanity. And in 5:8, Paul writes that Christ died for us. And the wording there doesn't mean that he died in our place. Paul means he died for our sake or for our benefit. And it's not surprising that Paul, who was once a Pharisee, a Jewish religious teacher and scholar, speaks about the death and resurrection of Christ in this ancient language of sacrifice and ritual. If you read my reflection in our recent Link Up Church newsletter, you know that I think that it's no coincidence that Jesus died during the Passover feast, the feast where Jews celebrated their freedom from captivity in Egypt, and how when they daubed their doorposts with the blood of a lamb, the angel of death passed over their homes and they remained safe. And so I really like to consider the death and resurrection of Jesus in this language of Passover, of freedom from captivity, of release from death and sin. Whatever language you like to use to try and articulate just how and why Jesus died for us, we all believe that he did die for us. Somehow his death made us right with God. Just in these 11 lines that we heard from Romans 5, Paul uses multiple different ways of explaining what Christ achieved. We have been justified. We have obtained access to grace. We have peace with God. We have a hope in sharing our glory with God. We have been saved from God's wrath. We are no longer enemies of God. We have received reconciliation. Seven things in 11 lines, which basically boil down to verse 6. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. We are weak. We are powerless. And despite what some may think, humanity cannot and will not save itself. That can only be achieved. That has already been achieved by an act of God. He has risen, just as he said, go and tell.